like it's hot and some sweat when the heat is on. Some feel the heat and decide that they can't go on.
Welcome to Green and Gold Forever. I'm Eric Drews, broadcasting from Oshkosh, Wisconsin, and we'll be joined shortly here by Matt McLean out in Altoona. And it's been almost over 24 hours now, and I think all of us are still on the top of the world. There is a lot to talk about in this game, but wow, what a finish. The Packers scoring a touchdown with just 3 seconds left, defeating the Miami Dolphins 27-24 in really a remarkable game on all fronts. Before we get into the details of everything, Matt, I guess going into that last drive, what was your confidence level that they were actually going to pull it out?
I guess I had some pretty good confidence. I mean, I wouldn't say I was overwhelmingly confident that they were going to go down and win it, but I mean, you feel like they've got a good chance because it seems like this team, whenever they have to do a drill like that, you know, like a two-minute type drill, they always seem to be pretty successful. But, I mean, the odds are definitely stacked against them. I mean, really, when that time was running down at the end there, once it got to about 6 seconds left, then my thoughts were that their chances were dwindling a little bit. It just seems like, you know, you get one play and you're done, and I didn't like those odds. But obviously they pulled it off, and just wow. I mean, the kind of game that everybody who's around Rodgers critic is looking for, and that's exactly what we got from him, is to kind of shut people up a little bit with that kind of a game.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, he was unbelievable that last drive, and he almost, and that's kind of the thing where the people who are on the comeback criticism, that this guy can't come from behind, is those happen to everybody. I mean, look at, he almost lost it with a fumble, and TJ Lang saved it. And if you are a critic and you want to point to that and say that's, you know, oh my gosh, he almost lost it. Well, that happens to everybody all the time. I mean, in a lot of Tom Brady's, I mean, even in the Super Bowl, he throws an almost interception every time. In his most famous comeback, depending on who you talk to, whether they're an Oakland Raider fan or not, he did fumble on his biggest first comeback. So for him to overcome that and to be able to lead them down, he makes a very smart yet gutsy play with the fake spike, throws it to Davante Adams, who played it perfectly, and then to trust Quarles, of all people, in that situation, to me, was amazing. I thought for sure, with 6 seconds left, you throw one jump ball to Jordy and take your chances, and the fact that they didn't even look to that side, and he zeroed in and threw it to Quarles because of the matchup, just shows you that he's going to throw to the open guy, but oh my gosh, if I was the quarterback, maybe, obviously there's multiple reasons why I'm not the quarterback, but to trust a guy like Quarles in that situation and not go to Nelson or Cobb was remarkable to me.
Yeah, and I think they had to. I think everybody in the world knew he was going to go to Nelson. If I was a defender, if I was a defensive coordinator, I probably would have double, triple teamed him on that play just because it's his favorite target. He's willing to throw the ball up for him. We've seen it on game-winning attempts before, try to go for him. So I think Quarles, say what you will about him. I mean, he's been fairly dependable. He's caught pretty much everything that's come at him this year. Mm-hmm. I know he's not an elite tight end, but he's made some nice plays. So he had the good matchup there, and that was really headsy by Rodgers to go that way. It is scary to put the game on the line to a guy like that, but I guess he's kind of growing on me a little bit this year, Quarles is. So I like the play, and I like the idea, and it was a great throw.
Yeah, I think he's having one of his better seasons. We like to refer to him as a puppy because he runs like a puppy, like he's not quite running how he's supposed to yet, and he's going to grow into his legs one of these days. So hopefully yesterday was a moment of growth for the old puppy runner. All right, let's talk about the game as a whole, and I'm having a hard time characterizing this one because, yes, there are a ton of problems with what we saw yesterday, but this is a game that drives folks like me nuts, who's a very stat-heavy guy and thinks that if you look at a game long enough and you look at the stats long enough and you break it down into small enough pieces that everything makes sense. And yesterday, more than ever, felt like a game where the coaches didn't even matter. It was man against man, and that last drive, it felt like the Packers offense was out there by themselves. And you just had to make it happen. And you want to explain, well, Dom's scheme wasn't good in the second half, or guys were figuring out with the read option. And there was some of that. But you look at the games that, or the plays that won the game yesterday, LaTroy Guyon on fourth and goal, blowing up the Miami offensive line, and Morgan Burnett, perfect contain and tackling one of the better running backs in the NFL. Lamar Miller having a wide open ocean of green in front of him on a third down. He should have gained 30 yards, and Brad Jones comes flying out of nowhere and cuts him down for like a 2-yard gain. I mean, just stuff like that. Aaron Rodgers keeping plays together forever. Devontae Adams being smart about staying in bounds on that big play. You had James Starks being clutch. Yesterday showed people like me that it isn't always about scheme. It's about blood and guts and just going out there and beating another football team. And I think they might have stole one a little bit, but this felt like the ultimate game where you can make a case the Packers didn't deserve to win, but they sure as hell didn't deserve to lose.
I think you hit it spot on. I mean, it was just a classic old-fashioned slugfest. And I think going into the game, if you told me Green Bay won by 3 points, I probably would have felt, you know, little on the fence about that, because I feel like they're a much better team than Miami. But when you actually watch the game yesterday, Miami, especially in that second half, they played lights out. Mm-hmm. I mean, that defense was great. Their offense was moving the ball at will against us. And I honestly, I don't even hold it against the Packers that much. I think Miami just really showed up and played really well. Mm-hmm. So I think if the Packers played that way yesterday against most teams, they probably win. I think Miami just, although I don't really like Tannehill, and I don't think they're a great team on most occasions, but they really played like it yesterday. So you could look at it as a 3-point win over the Dolphins, but I think it's a huge 3-point win over the Dolphins.
Yeah, definitely. And I'm much more impressed by the Dolphins than I was,
yeah,
you know, at this time 2 days ago. That pass rush is unbelievable. Cameron Wake is a beast. They have Brett Grimes and Cortland Finnegan, both have been around a while and kind of have reputations, but I thought they played pretty well yesterday, and that if Tannehill actually plays more like second-half Tannehill and not first-half Tannehill, yeah, this team could be a mover in the AFC.
Yeah, he looked terrible in the first half and was completely different in the second half. And as you mentioned, the pass rush, I mean, they were sending only 4 guys a lot of times and getting home every time. Rodgers only got sacked 3 times, but it felt like a lot more.
Yeah.
And it just seemed like he was constantly moving out of the pocket. And then you look and there's just 4 guys, just the front 4 coming at him, mm-hmm, and they couldn't stop it. So it was a really nice job by Miami. Wasn't enough, but they did what they had to do on defense, I think, to win. If it wasn't for Tannehill, first half Tannehill, as you mentioned, I think they definitely would have won.
Yeah, they really held on for dear life in that first half, and the Packers' offense came out guns blazing and then couldn't do anything. It felt almost, not quite as bad, but almost as bad as that 2012 Seattle game from that point forward, where Rodgers just couldn't do anything.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't really, it never felt like it was his fault. It was Brian Bulaga was getting whipped, and even Josh Sitton, there was a play where he just got knocked right over and ended up rolling at Aaron Rodgers' feet, and he was away from the play. It's like, at the play, the point of attack, those Dolphins were just geared up, and I don't know if it was that the Joe Philbin effect or if this just was one of their biggest games all year, so they were really jacked up for it.
Yep.
But, man, it part of me at halftime, what, they were up 10-3, I just felt like they were going to lose from that point on, because I'm like, how do you get 2 interceptions and a goal line stand and you are only up 10-3? That just gave me a really bad feeling. But then that second half was just remarkable on both fronts, really.
Yeah, and I guess I almost felt the opposite after the first half, as I felt they were just so much better that they were just going to pull away in the second half and that we were going to see more of the same, but something definitely switched at halftime and Miami came out swinging. So it was I definitely want to watch that game over a couple of times here and kind of watch it again to really appreciate it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you mentioned that Lang fumble recovery on the final drive there. I almost forgot about that because he also had the fake spike and then you had the game-winning touchdown. There was just so much that happened.
Not to mention the 4th and 10 where he got plowed over and still made a laser shot to Jordy Nelson.
Yeah. I mean, that last drive, there were so many pieces that if one thing doesn't happen, you're done. But everything fell into place perfectly and that fumble recovery was huge. And
yeah,
just everything fit perfectly into place for that to happen.
Yeah, and it feels like we said for so long that the Packers never win these kind of games, and now they always win these kind of games.
Yeah.
They had this one. They had the second biggest comeback in franchise history against the Jets. They had the number one biggest comeback in franchise history at the end of last year, and of course, who could forget that Chicago Bear game? So for a lot of the critics of McCarthy and Rodgers saying that they just didn't have the gumption to be able to come back when somebody hits them in the mouth, they're really proving otherwise so far. And obviously the teammates are there too.
Yeah, I mean, they're winning the games that they're supposed to, like they always have. But now they're starting to win these games that are on the fence. Now they just have to win the games they're not expected to win, because those are still the ones they don't win.
Yeah, yeah, that's true. The thing I'll bring up, and we're going to have kind of an abbreviated version of the show with Matt today, as he's got some other commitments, but before the game, everybody talked about the Heat, and I might have talked about it on the podcast last week, but I just thought, wow, how stupid, how overrated is the Heat? Let's quit talking about that. And then by the second quarter, Jordy Nelson looked like he hadn't had a drop of water in 3 days. And just the rest of the team just looked like they were going to keel over. TJ Lang said he could hardly remember the fumble recovery because he was sort of blacking out. He was so tired at that point in the game. I couldn't believe it had that much of an effect, and I think that just goes to show you that's another reason that this team really should be proud of themselves about yesterday.
Yeah, it's a big deal. When I play football, I hated playing in noon games, especially in the middle of the summer. And now imagine you're used to this 40, 50-degree weather when you're at home, and then you go into that. I mean, that's a big shock. Mm-hmm. You can practice in it a couple days before the game starts, but you can't prepare for that. And what you have to go through during a game in that kind of heat, it's unbearable. So for a team from Miami, you hate to put too much emphasis on that, but it is a big deal. And I think it was big that they overcame that. I think it was pretty significant. So I think that, again, like you said, that's another reason they should be really proud.
Yeah, although they did have the guys holding those big shielders up and kind of protecting
that's
them.
Yeah, funny.
Yeah, and I was wondering who was holding the bigger shielders to protect the big shielder guys.
The shielder guys, were they from Green Bay? That all depends on that. If they were Miami shielder guys, they probably didn't need it.
They were just like, oh, man, I need a coat. It's cold out here, probably. All right, there were some more injuries yesterday. I don't really have an update on any of those. Tremont Williams said after the game he thought he would be okay. At first, they were worried that Sam Shields tore his patella tendon, but if you watched the Sunday night game and saw the reaction that Victor Cruz had to tearing his patella tendon, that seems highly unlikely to me that Sam Shields would have suffered that injury. Cruz reacted like he got shot. Ridiculous pain. I felt so bad for him. I hope he does recover, not to go to a sidebar, but people were talking about yesterday how devastating of an injury it is, and it is probably, but it's 2014 now, it'll be 2015 next year, and Robert Brooks tore his patella tendon and almost every single ligament in his knee in 1996 and came back in 1997 and had a 1,000-yard season. So hopefully Victor Cruz, you know, he's annoying because he was on the Giants team that tore us apart, but I really like him and I hope he gets better.
Yeah, he's still young and athletic, I think. You know, if anybody can do it, it's probably a guy like that, so hopefully he comes back next year. And you don't really hear that injury a whole lot very often, so I guess I don't even really have a timetable. I mean, you mentioned Robert Brooks, but I can't think of any other major players who've had that recently.
I remember, I think Corell Buchholter had that. I don't know why that one sticks in my head, because I think there are just so few of those.
Yeah.
Imagine the force it takes to snap your patella tendon. I mean, that's not a small thing. I mean, it doesn't it cover the whole surface area of your kneecap?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, yeah, ouch. That goes without saying. I wanted to bring up, there were some guys on defense that played okay. I thought Julius Peppers was good again. Clay Matthews is always a force, but, God, I texted you that him and Brad Jones treat play action like it's sorcery. And it was very apparent that yesterday, but we have to talk about Ha-Ha Clinton Dix, and this guy every week looks like he's aging by 3 or 4 games. I mean, he has just gone from iffy, maybe will he get on the field, to almost indispensable member of the defense.
Yeah, he's got to be out there.
Yeah, he's just a fun guy to watch. He's all over the place all the time. He's a ball hawk. He's a tough tackler. He reacts quickly, and I think I haven't seen enough of the Jets, but just hearing about what happened with Kelvin Pryor, the Packers lucked out, and they got the right guy.
Yeah, and I don't know if you remember in Week 1, he was getting a lot of heat after that game because he missed a lot of plays, but on our show I talked about how I actually thought it was good because he was in position to make these plays and just wasn't making them yet. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as he progressed, he would start making them, and that's exactly what he's doing. He's in position now, and he's making the tackles, and he's making big hits, and that's, you know, what else can you hope for this? So, you know, with some injuries at the corners, hopefully that kind of frees up Hyde potentially to play a little bit of nickel or corner, because you've got a pretty solid tandem in Dix and Burnett in the back.
Yeah, and Burnett played pretty good too. yesterday.
Yeah, he did, actually. And I'm one of his biggest critics. I'm always a big critic of safety number 42s for the Packers, I feel like. But he's,
well, some of those safety number 42s deserve the criticism more than even we imagined.
Yeah, that's true. But he played really well yesterday. I can't say anything bad about it. So if he can play more like that or more like he did at the end of last season, then I'm perfectly happy with him starting.
Yesterday was the best I've seen this Packer team tackle in at least 4 years. It just felt like nobody was getting away. That play on the goal line where they stopped him, not only was everybody there, but Burnett made a huge play. Guy on, guess the gap, right? He got through, he disrupted, but then it's still one-on-one Burnett and Lamar Miller, and Burnett got a hold of him, and he stonewalled him, and then the rest of his teammates came and piled on, and that was just one example. Brad Jones had the big, it was funny because Lamar Miller had this play on third down. I don't know if you remember it, but it was like a draw play in the second half, and he had a ton of real estate, and Brad Jones comes flying up and cuts him down, and I was like, yeah, nice play, haha, and they showed Brad Jones. I'm like, what? I like literally said that aloud. I can't believe it was Brad Jones, and he had some iffy plays yesterday, but still, everybody came to play at certain points, and they needed all of them.
Yeah, I remember after that play thinking, I was like, 59, 59, 59, who the hell is that again? It was like, they showed, I was like, holy cow, that's Brad Jones?
Nyel Biggs.
Like, I almost forgot about him for a second. He tends to do that sometimes. He'll just make a big play and make, like, five terrible ones, but he definitely didn't do that yesterday. So he had a couple of really nice tackles that were kind of unexpected.
Yeah, and Ryan Tannehill threw a bad ball that stoinked off his head, so he saved a touchdown accidentally. Well, I know, Matt, you're hard pressed for time here, so let's just wrap this up pretty quick. We're not going to do a pick segment this week. We'll probably pick the Packer game. I was going to volunteer that I take Matt's picks and then read them, and then talk about mine, and then also read Matt's. But everybody knows, including myself, that I'm a ruthless cheater, and
I
can't
trust
be
you.
Trusted. So I just wanted to say this. I think that I've seen better officiating in pro wrestling than the NFL has had this year. They should have a run-in. They should bring steel chairs to the next games, because I don't think it matters if the NFL decides they're not going to call something, because yesterday was embarrassing. A face mask on Casey Hayward, where the guy doesn't even go to the ground. He just one yank of it. Casey Hayward does a spiral to the ground. The referee's like, no, yeah, that's probably physically possible. I think that's a clean tackle. Aaron Rodgers getting blown away. He should have changed at halftime and put a Tom Brady number 12 on to try to get some calls. He was just abused. The same thing, Miami players getting held. I know this has got to be annoying for people to hear this constantly, but it's barn ball out there. And not only that, it's so inconsistent from week to week. I don't even know how the players are supposed to play for this. This is an NFL issue. It again goes back to the point where they don't care in the least who wins the games, but holy cow, do you risk soiling your brand if it's that apparent that the rules don't matter to you?
Yeah, and you said it's barn ball, but I think even more importantly when you said it's inconsistent is, yeah, you'll have one game that's barn ball like yesterday, but you'll have another game where nothing goes, where they call absolutely everything, and there's just absolutely no consistency, and I know we've beaten this horse to death, and we kind of both feel the same way. What do you say at this point? I just don't know how it's so inconsistent from referee group to referee group. I don't get it either. I mean, what else can you say at this point? It's just going to be what it is. I feel like there's no more emphasis on it than there was 3 years ago when we started talking about this.
And I don't even blame the referees, because I read an article yesterday where the referees have come out and said, what are we supposed to do? Because when we get our grades, you grade us highly, and then you come out and the league itself criticizes some of our calls in public. So what do you want from us? Mm-hmm. And I just don't think it's a big enough emphasis. And that's I promise it's the last time I say it for a while, but it sucks when you're an invested fan of a particular team, because the NFL could care in the least who wins the individual games. The Packers could get screwed six times this year, and it could cost them the playoffs, and the NFL does not care, because that wild card game between the Detroit Lions and the Arizona Cardinals is going to get a 25 rating on NBC, so they don't care at all, and it just really sucks if you actually care who wins an individual game.
Yep.
And the other thing I was going to bring up of the Packers, and then I have one NFL topic that I'd really like to get your thoughts on, and then I'll let you out of here. Is there any chance Starks could take Lacy's job?
That's a tough one. I mean, Lacy, again, only 2.9 yards a carry. Starks with 3.9, so I mean, not stellar, but he definitely looked like the better of the two yesterday. Mm-hmm. I think it's going to take a lot. I think that he could probably take some carries, and he was only 14-8 in terms of carries yesterday, so that's actually a little bit closer than it's been.
Yeah.
I think he might keep stealing carries. He's a really nice, kind of a different pace from, like, Lacy. I think that they could maybe even get pretty close to splitting, and yeah, it wouldn't be the worst thing in the world to keep Lacy a little bit more fresh. I don't think he's going to be the starter, definitely not this season, unless Lacy really tanks and just keeps kind of going at the same pace as he has been, but I could definitely see him getting more and more carries. There was a couple weeks where he wasn't getting any, and now he's taken almost half.
Yeah, and I think yesterday was just kind of working, but Lacy looked like old Eddie George at times yesterday and this year, and we've brought up the shotgun, and Mike McCarthy on one of his recent TV shows, he addressed this. He's like, yeah, everybody's been saying, why am I not running Lacy out of the shotgun? He's like, statistically, Eddie Lacy was better out of the shotgun last year than he was under center. And so he wasn't saying it because he's got to defend his player, but he's like, I don't know what else I'm supposed to do when we're not getting production. And Starks was doing better, but we've seen Starks in the past where, you know, that whole run in 2011 when we wanted him to be the feature back, you'd get a week where he'd torch somebody, usually the Vikings, which apparently is what our running backs are built for,
yeah,
and he'd come back the next week and he'd struggle. He'd get 25 carries for 60 yards, and he'd be in the same thing. So I don't know what the answer is, and I don't know if it's the scheme or what, but Aaron Rodgers is on pace right now for 40 touchdowns with 3 picks, and so I just feel like, who cares about the running game? Let's just let's use it as kind of a fun play thing, and let's actually score some points with the passing game.
Yeah, I mean, just go with what works every week. When you've got a passing game that's working like it's working right now, you don't, I think, have to put too much emphasis on who's getting the ball, or, you know, if Lacy's, you know, not too happy that he's only getting 14 carries in a game, just do what works. I don't care. Get the win.
Mm-hmm.
Whoever's getting you more yardage that game against any particular defense, if Lacy matches up better against maybe a smaller defense, and Starks is, you know, more of a cutter and a little bit more speed guy against, you know, a slower defense or something, do that. I don't care who it is, just maybe get the better matchup in there. And it seems like Starks is just getting better and better.
Yeah, and I don't know, he feels like, I hate to use tired cliches, that's like one of my biggest pet peeves, and we've done well about not doing that on this show, but he seems like he has fresh legs when he's not
yeah.
the dependent guy. So I guess I would be weary of messing with that dynamic and just hope that Lacy catches on.
Well, we saw that last year. What did he average per carry? It was
like 5 yards or something.
Yeah, and I mean, his carries were less, so when he's not the feature back, he seems to be, you know, dynamite out of the backfield. So if they can keep that going, maybe even toss DeJuan Harrison there for a carry or two. He tends to do pretty well when he gets a couple of carries, so just maybe mix it up a little bit more. Kuhn for 4 carries for 15 yards, too. That was kind of unexpected.
Yeah, they had, what, 2 straight carries of 4 yards, and they were like the toughest 4 yards that our running backs will get all season. But then on third down, I can't remember if they gave it to Lacy or somebody else. I'm like, I kind of wanted to see Kuhn again. But, yeah, that was interesting. So all across the board, though, every yard yesterday was earned, and that's the kind of blood and guts football game that we were worried about losing with the new rules, and that the NFC Championship game that we both praised was a lot like. And so to see the Packers, of all teams, win one of those games is amazing. And I texted you that after the game. I think I did. But anyways, that was one of my favorite Packer regular season games that I can remember off the top of my head, and I think it's going to be for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, before I let you go, the NFL had another tie yesterday. The Carolina Panthers, whom the Packers are playing on Sunday, tied the Cincinnati Bengals in hilarious fashion of Mike Nugent missing a chip shot field goal as time expired. The NFL had 17 ties from 1974, when they instituted regular season overtime, and 2011, which was the entire period of the traditional overtime sudden death rules. Now that they've instituted this first to six, everybody gets a possession type overtime, they've had 3 overtime games in 3 seasons, and they've had several other very close calls. If you'll remember, in 2012, the teams playing tonight, the Rams and 49ers nearly tied twice.
Yep.
And the 49ers kicked a game-winning field goal as time expired. I think there was another game last year, where a team kicked a field goal with like 4 seconds left in overtime. And so I don't think you want to do it right now, but A, do you think in a couple years, if we're still getting ties every year, that they need to reevaluate it? And B, let's assume for fun that you do think they should reevaluate it. Do you have any idea what they should change it to?
I think this is one of those things, and I don't like changing much in the NFL, but I think this is something you can pretty constantly evaluate until you feel that you get it right. I do like this better than what they had. I know you get a couple more ties, but I feel like it is more fair.
Yeah.
I'm not complaining about it, but I agree. Nobody likes to see ties, and in an NFL world where it's all about fantasy and instant gratification, to end in a tie, I mean, it's just so unsatisfying. I know that college football overtime is pretty popular, but I don't know if I really want to see that either in the NFL.
I hate the college overtime.
Yeah, I wouldn't mind change, but I don't have a better idea, I guess, is my answer.
Yeah, and I definitely don't want them to go the college route, which I'm afraid they're going to do. I'd rather have ties every year than the college overtime because I just feel it's too far away from the normal game.
Yeah.
It's a step better than having a home run derby instead of extra innings in baseball.
Yep.
And I think if I'm the NFL and I'm looking at these, and let's say ties are on the rise and 5 years from now we're getting a tie every season, I think in one aspect that's concerning to me because it's not very good for the paying customer. It's not great on TV, especially if you have a big primetime game. Like imagine if the Patriots and Colts would – the Colts, I always think Peyton Manning Colts. The Patriots and the Broncos would tie or something like that. I mean that – wouldn't be great for the league, and it would suck for the paying customer. It's bad for gambling. But on the other hand, it throws a huge extra monkey wrench into playoff seedings, which makes the last 2 or 3 weeks much more interesting. The Packers were saved by their tie last year and would have been out at the Pittsburgh game had they not tied Minnesota. So I think in that aspect, which is rare for this new NFL to show some patience if they say, yeah, you might get some week 4 ties, but then week 17 is going to be awesome if you just hang on.
Yeah.
So, all right, last thing before you go, who you got on Sunday, Packers and Panthers?
I was feeling pretty confident in Packers, actually, before the last game. Seeing Carolina's offense against a pretty good defense concerns me a little bit. I thought that offense could be held in check to probably less than 14 points, maybe even. But Cam Newton played really well. I still think I like Green Bay, especially being at home. I just think they've got a lot more offensive firepower. I'm a little concerned with the cornerback situation. I know Carolina doesn't have much for wide receivers, but if they got third and fourth corner they're going against, they might be able to get some stuff done. I'll take Green Bay in a close one and a low-scoring one. I'm thinking like 20-17 in a close one.
Okay. Yeah, and I could see that. You bring up some really good points, but I don't trust Cam Newton that much. Apparently I'm into the lettering today. That's the second time I've done the A-B thing.
Keep
but anyway.
Going.
What was that?
Keep it going.
Okay, well, A, I don't trust Cam Newton. And B, Carolina's defense vanished after week 2.
Yeah,
they've given up
true.
37 or more points 3 of the last 4 weeks. I don't know what the hell happened to them, but Joe Flacco and, well, maybe you just have to be in the AFC North, so Cleveland should be really excited to play the Carolina Panthers because they've given up 37 to Pittsburgh, 38 to Baltimore, and 37 to Cincinnati. I think the Packers can do the same, and I have no reason to believe that Carolina's defense is going to get any better by Sunday, so I think the Packers are going to win. I actually think it's going to be a high-scoring game.
I was the idiot that drafted Carolina as their defense in both fantasy leagues that I'm in this year.
At least you weren't the idiot who drafted St. Louis in both fantasy leagues.
And watching the pregame on Sunday, they were talking about how stout their defense was, and I saw Gio Bernard got like an 80-yard touchdown run. They're like, man, against this tough of a defense, incredible. I was like, no, this defense has been absolutely miserable this year. And it's a big misconception that their defense is, you know, top 3 at this point. It was really good last year, but it's been really bad this year.
Do you remember how they were the year before? Like, it was last year a one-year anomaly, or have they been good since Rivera got there?
I think they're getting exposed a little bit for what they are. They've got a really good front seven, like a lot of teams in the NFC, but their secondary is pretty weak, kind of like San Francisco's getting exposed a little bit now this year.
Yeah.
They have holes, and teams are finding their ways around it, and if anybody can find holes in a secondary, it's probably Aaron Rodgers.
Yeah, so let's hope he can find the holes, expose this defense. None of them sound very good, so let's hope that Aaron Rodgers puts up a lot of yards and points on the Carolina Panthers. Okay, Matt, we're going to let you go here, and thanks for joining us on the podcast. I'm going to come back after a short break, and I'll talk us some other random crap, but take care, have a good week, and send me your picks on Facebook so that way I can manipulate them.
All right, sounds good. Will do.
All right, see you, Matt.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Green and Gold Forever. I'm still Eric Drews, still broadcasting from Oshkosh, Wisconsin. And I'm going to be honest with you here. I just recorded a segment, probably about 30 minutes long, talking about the Bart Starr era Packers. And I'm going to post that as is on here. The audio quality is horrible. I almost didn't post it. There was a problem with the microphone where it wasn't plugged in properly. So my microphone, I switched programs between talking to Matt and then recording on my own. So the microphone that I usually use was not plugged in properly. So the back mic on the laptop was what was recording there. So the audio is not great. I apologize for that, but I thought I would just post it. If anybody listens this far and wants to hear that stuff, they want to hear that kind of content anyway. So I'm going to just let it stand for what it is. But I also want to mention, before I get to the last segment, that once again, Green and Gold Forever is going to be on KZ Radio for our Friday preview of the upcoming Packer game against Carolina. That's 92.9 in Appleton and the Fox Cities. That's 104.3 in Green Bay, and always on mykzradio.com. Not only are you going to get a preview of the Carolina game, here's some keys to the game as well as some stats about the history of the Packers versus Panthers. They play some awesome music. If you like any of the songs that I use at the beginning of this podcast, you're going to love KZ Radio. Every time I go in there, I hear some songs that I haven't heard for years or haven't heard at all and that I really enjoy. So I think you'll enjoy it too. So definitely help us out, help KZ Radio out, and listen on your afternoon. It'll be a great, great fun time on Friday and every day during the afternoon. They have some great, great songs. So if you like those kind of songs, you'll probably like to hear about the 1970s and 80s Green Bay Packers. So that's what I got here. I warn you, it's a very disorganized segment, just kind of me rambling about my notes, but I'll explain that in the intro to that. So thanks, everybody, for listening, and I hope you enjoy this segment. And I didn't want to end the podcast so soon, and it's always fun to talk history on this show. After all, that's what we're all about. That's what we were founded on. And so I've had something that has been sitting on my to-do list for a long time now. I wasn't sure whether it was going to be an article or a standalone podcast, and I thought I'd take this opportunity to do it now. It's something that I had the working title of Observations from My Journey Through Packers Hell. And I've referenced it many times on this podcast that I'm a collector of old Packer games. I have been for really my entire adult life and even going back into my high school days, where anytime anybody had an old attic full of tapes, I'd get my hands on them and see if there are any Packer games in there, and I collected anything I could. And recently I was able to get my hands on games I had never seen before from an era that almost nobody talks about, and that's the Bart Starr head coach era of the Packers. And the years that I was able to get games from were 1977 through 1983, which 83 was the last year that Bart Starr was the coach. And I had a chance to watch around 30 or 40 games from those, what is that, seven seasons? And I just kind of took down some general observations, and this might be a very random podcast. I'm just going to go down my notes as I saw them and maybe elaborate on them. It's been a few months now since I watched all of these games, but I still think that this could be kind of fun. And so I'll talk about these as much as I can. While I sit here by myself, I'm going to be drinking out of my Green Bay Packers 1991 Collector's Cup. I'm trying the Mike's Shandy Hard Lemonade Lager that a friend of mine gave me a free case of because he liked them so much that he's giving them away. And so I'm going to, I don't know, maybe I'll call this a fireside chat. I mean, certainly me and FDR got to be up there with interesting things to say, right? So let's get started, and we'll start in 1977, and my first note here is Willie Buchanan is awesome. And if you don't know who Willie Buchanan is, he was a star Packer defensive back in the 1970s, played from 1972 through 1978, actually won Rookie of the Year, and he's unbelievable. On these old games, he's all over the place. He had four interceptions, which is an NFL record. He had four interceptions in one game against the San Diego Chargers in 1978. Next to yesterday is probably one of the hottest games that the Packers have ever played in, so that was kind of interesting. But that guy was just all over the place, and had he been on some of the good Packer teams, he'd be remembered as one of the greatest in franchise history, and now he's a name that you really don't hear much at all. And so it was kind of fun to see him play. He shared the backfield with
Johnny Gray, who, if you're up in the Green Bay area and watch any of the local Packer television programming, you're quite familiar with Johnny Gray. He's been up here for pretty much since he retired. And I yelled at him one time, "Hey, Johnny Gray," at Lambeau Field, and he waved and gave me thumbs up. So Johnny Gray is also a very cool guy, but he's a fun player to watch. He was in the backfield for quite a while. And they also had Steve Luke, who was a safety who admittedly I had never heard of before I started watching these games. And as they went on, the way I set it up is I got them, but I didn't know who was going to win them, and I didn't go back and look at who won the games before I watched them. So I was getting to watch them for the first time, and almost as close to as I would have watched them back in the day. I had no idea who was going to win. I didn't know who a lot of the players were, and I watched them in order so I could kind of see him develop. And Steve Luke was a guy who just really came across as a hard-hitting safety, made a lot of plays. He was like a general in the backfield, and while the Packers' defense struggled, they had a very good secondary, and all three of those guys are worthy of being mentioned. I'm going to have to elaborate much more quickly and succinctly in order for this podcast to not be 4 hours long. But my next note is, as I said, the 1977 season was the first season in which I had stuff that I could watch. And if you're a longtime fan of NFL history or have knowledge of NFL history, 1978 was a big year, as that's when they had the first emphasis of not pass interference, not illegal contact, things like that. It's excuse me, it's called the Mel Blount Rule, if you ever want to look that up, because it was a big thing. It was added in 1978, and basically what it was is defenders were no longer permitted to make contact with receivers beyond 5 yards. So it's kind of the Chuck Rule, but before that, you were given liberty to, I don't want to say maul receivers, but you could do a lot more. You could be a lot more handsy, you could disrupt routes, you could do a lot more, and the difference between watching those 1977 games and those 1978 games, even for a bad team like the Packers, is remarkable. The 1977 games are horrible. And it just, offense is so hard to come by. Passing the football just is incredibly difficult. And if you look at the statistics, the mid-70s, 75, 76, 77, quarterback ratings and completion percentages and things like that are worse those years than they are even in like the 40s and the 50s when passing was relatively new. And so those changes are mocked sometimes, and they're said to be targeting the Steelers and things like that. And I'm not from 1978, so I don't know. That could be true in the same way that it felt like it was true this past offseason that they were targeting Seattle. But it was a good thing, and there's a balance there. When we talk about our disdain for the new rule changes, which don't appear to have happened at all, having watched the referees, but the rule change this year feels like it's a bit too much. They're opening it up too much. But if you're watching games in 1977, that was absolutely essential to change that game. It's not bad, and if you're older than me and remember that from your youth or remember that from having watched it live, you might have a difference of opinion, but that running back-based 5 yards, 4 yards, 3 yards, just pounding it up the middle, and every yard is earned the hard way, there's a charm to that, yes, but watching that week in and week out is not as good as it is today, and certainly not as good as it was from 1978 until, 2004 when they had the next rules emphasis. So those were absolutely essential. Once again, I'm getting through this really fast. I'm just going to pound through some of my notes here. The 1978 Packers are no longer a mystery to me. They're a team that is incredibly interesting. They started the season 7-2, finished 8-7-1, and their offense goes from one of the highest scoring teams in the league to the second half of the season having scored the fewest points in the league. It's ridiculous. Go to Pro Football Reference sometime and look up the 78 Packers, and you'll notice this strange line where they're scoring 20, 30. They had a game where they scored 45 points in a single game, and then all of a sudden they can't even score touchdowns. It's ridiculous. And for years, I always wondered why that happened, and it turns out it's not a mystery. They had David Whitehurst, who's Charlie Whitehurst's father, for the Packers. He was a very nice guy. He was voted the most popular player on the team, even as he was having his struggles, so the fans liked him. He wasn't all that talented, but he also had absolutely no pass protection that year. And it's apparent, even when the Packers are winning, they can't pass protect. And so the 78 Packers, for the maybe one or two other people on the face of the earth that are still wondering why the 78 Packers fell apart. It's because they had no pass rush. Steve Odom, a young Packer receiver at the time, was a kick returner. He's a very little scrappy guy. Maybe Darren Sproles-like, but a little bit bigger, more of a wide receiver. He was a Packer that a lot of people don't remember. All I have on here was I love Steve Odom is literally what I wrote. And I've had the fun note that he was going for his doctorate in clinical psychology. So he obviously is a very smart guy. And I didn't look him up, but I hope he's still out and kicking and doing all them great things. The NFL schedule was weird back then for other tidbits. The Packers started at 1 o'clock Central Time. And by the time they started, there were other games that were already approaching halftime. They really staggered them more like baseball does now, where they started at 1 o'clock wherever you were. So if you're in the East Coast, it started at 1 o'clock. If you're at Central, 1 o'clock. West Coast, 1 o'clock. So if you're watching as a Central Time Zone viewer, like I would have been back in 1978, our game started an hour after the NFL games in the East started, but then the late games start at 3 o'clock Central, so 4 o'clock Eastern, I think. Anyways, I don't want to do the math right now, but basically what would happen is that the doubleheader that you have today basically didn't exist. So if you're in the Central time zone, you would join that second game almost to halftime because you were an hour behind. And so I don't have any games that had pregame, so I don't know if you got an hour of a game and then it kicked you to your game. I would assume, being the 70s, that you probably just got the NFL Today pregame show on tape delay, and then you watched your game, and then you got the last 2 hours of the late game. So it's very weird, and I think it's 1980 or 81, I didn't write it down here, is when they changed the schedule to the format that we have today, where all the early games start at the same time and all the late games start at the same time. So be thankful that happened, because you're getting to see a lot more football than your counterparts in the 1970s. I just put a note on here because I'd never heard of the injury before. Some poor guy in the 1978 Packers-Bears game missed the game for the Bears because, according to the announcer, he suffered a ruptured testicle. I don't know how one goes about doing that, and I don't care to give it one more second of thought, but I'll throw that out there. Another thing is, some of the games I had commercials, which, if you're a history buff and an old NFL buff like me, it was maybe the best part about the old games is seeing the ads, and a lot of them are incredibly racist. You wouldn't believe how far we've come as a society in just 35 years, but a lot of the ads are very, very racist. And there's also some really funny things in there. There was a 1979 ad with Earl Campbell describing about how he loves when the game is over because he can go to the beach and chill out and do his favorite thing, which is Skoal chewing tobacco. And it helps him get the ladies. And then the ad ends with a voiceover saying that Skoal is the official sponsor of the 1980 U.S. Olympic team. So very different times that we live in today. The one thing I wanted to bring up, too, is the Packers had some really fun defensive talent that somehow didn't translate into great defenses. But Ezra Johnson is another guy, great pass rusher, reminds me a lot of Vonnie Holiday, not just because of the number, but a really solid defensive end that was a very popular player. And Mike Butler, too, was a defensive lineman who was a really fun guy to watch. Whenever there's disruption in the backfield in those old games, it's always Ezra Johnson and Mike Butler. So I thought I'd throw those out there as guys that you can appreciate if you've never heard of them before. The Packer fan loyalty is something I wanted to bring up. The Packers in 1978, they have that great start, and then in November, they host the Cowboys, the defending Super Bowl champions. They have Roger Staubach at quarterback. They have Tony Dorsett in the backfield. Tony Dorsett, by the way, is awesome. I'd never seen him play in his prime. I just heard about him, and he needs more discussion as being one of the best of all time. The guy just glides around. He's powerful. He's fast. And in the 70s, when there isn't a lot of room to run and open up the offense, he just looks completely unstoppable. So Tony Dorsett, another guy that's awesome. Walter Payton, everything I said about Dorsett is also good about Walter Payton. Saw him in a couple of games, and he's unbelievable. As good as everybody ever says he is, is Walter Payton. But anyways, the Packers play Dallas. It's the biggest game ever. It's the biggest game basically in maybe 10 years in 78, trying to beat the Cowboys to really cement themselves as a contender for the Super Bowl in 1978. They go up 7-0. The crowd is insane, thinking that the Packers are, you know, wow, they're going to beat Dallas. And then Dallas responds by scoring 42 unanswered points to just basically beat the Packers into dust. David Whitehurst can't do anything. The defense can't stop anybody. But to the Packer fan credit, this is a team that is 10 years removed from the greatest dynasty in pro football history, and to this day is still the best dynasty in pro football history. Matt and I have speculated that Packer fans, at least maybe this generation, would abandon ship if it ever got as bad as it did then. Well, these 1978 fans had just had their hearts ripped out in a game that they had built up. They thought it was going to be their crowning achievement. They ended up getting absolutely pulverized, losing 42-7. They score a garbage touchdown to lose 42-14, and the crowd goes nuts. They're so happy to have scored a touchdown. They cheer almost as loud as they cheer for that first quarter touchdown. So, Packer fans of today, we have a standard that we have to uphold if the Packers ever get bad again, because those fans from the 70s and 80s, they were there till the bitter end, so they deserve some credit too, along with the Packers players of the lean years. The Packers fans of the lean years need some help as well. Some other comparisons I'd written out here: Steve Largent, great wide receiver for the Seattle Seahawks. He's incredibly fun to watch. Jim Zorn, who was the ex-Redskins coach in 2008-2009, was the quarterback for the Seahawks in the 70s and actually ended up being the quarterback for the Packers in 1985 after some injuries. But he was really fun to watch, running all over the place, and just a guy who I'd never seen play at all, just knew his name from being the coach of the Redskins and being an ex-Packer, and it was fun to see him. He's a really, really good player, and so is Steve Largent, worthy of his Hall of Fame. And Archie Manning, I had a couple Archie Manning games, and definitely plays much different than his two sons. You think of Peyton and you think of Eli, and they're kind of statues out there. Archie Manning plays almost identical to Andrew Luck, oddly enough. And there's a game where the Packers get way ahead, and then he brings the Saints way back, and they lose. But it was fun seeing Archie out there in all his glory, and really fun, exciting player to watch. I still stand by what I said in one of our what-ifs, that I don't think he's necessarily this great quarterback who got stuck with a bad team, but it's somewhat true. He was better than his Saints teammates. He probably could have done some good things had he been on some good teams, but he wasn't going to be Peyton and take a 3-13 team into a 12 straight playoff appearances. But he's certainly fun to watch, much like Andrew Luck. I guess I don't have to go into all these things. Mike Douglas, the linebacker for the Packers, in the Packer Hall of Fame. The 2014 Packers need a Mike Douglas. This guy, well, I think they called him Mad Dog. He was just all over the place all the time, making plays. He was a tough physical linebacker. He wasn't cheap. Just a really, really fun player to watch. And I can understand why people still remember him amongst people who remember these old games. The Packers had their own John Kuhn back in the day, Barty Smith, not just because he's a white running back, but because he was kind of slow and a utility guy, but a lot of people got behind him and he was fun to watch. I have so many notes here that I can't possibly talk about all of these. The 1979 opener is one of the most heartbreaking games I've ever seen. I had no idea who won. The Packers lost at Chicago 6-3, and it actually was a much more entertaining game than a 6-3 score would suggest. But it was heartbreaking. I knew that the Packers weren't going to be that great, but they had just come off having Terdell Middleton, who was the first 1,000-yard rusher for the Packers since John Brockington, and looked to be this young guy who was going to carry the Packers forward. The announcers talk about him in that previously mentioned Cowboys game. Like, him and Tony Dorsett are, like, neck and neck for the best running back in the NFL. I think that was premature to say that, but at the very least, you can think what the people that were his contemporaries were thinking about what kind of potential Terdell Middleton had, and it didn't pan out. And this first game, he's not very good. He gets hurt. And then also Eddie Leivry, who was supposed to be their difference-making running back. He's a fast, quick-cutting running back, very entertaining to watch. He has three carries. And the first two carries, I'm like, oh my gosh, this Eddie Leivry is going to be awesome. Unfortunately, I knew what was going to happen to Eddie Lee Ivory. I didn't know what was going to happen in this game, and he blows out his knee. And it was so dramatic that I actually, watching this 35 years later, I went, oh no, when he tore his ACL, because just seeing how great he was before that injury, even in limited time, it just makes you wonder how good he could have been. And he came back and he actually played for the Packers for another 6-7 years, but he just never quite, and I don't know this for sure, I haven't seen all the games, but even in the games I saw after his injury, he just didn't seem to have the explosion he had in those first couple plays. So, man, that sucked. I feel so bad for the Packers of that era, and I'm kind of glad that I got to sit out a lot of this heartbreak because, gosh, they got their fair share of it. Whitehurst was horrible. James Lofton, who I don't think I need to elaborate on how good James Lofton is. He is unbelievable, but he drops a lot of passes for a really good receiver, and he has two huge drops in these in this game. There's just some other things I'm going to throw out there. Lynn Dickey is horrible before the Packers trade for John Jefferson in 1981. I mean, he's like Blaine Gabbert bad at times. And I know this is when he was super banged up. I've referenced Dickey a lot on this show, but yeah, John Jefferson comes on the scene, and this Packer offense transforms into this exciting offense that can't be stopped. The running game starts getting going again, and then Lynn Dickey turns into old Brett Favre, basically, for the rest of his career, with all of the good and the bad of old Brett Favre. I've elaborated on that on the podcast before, too. But, yeah, those are really kind of the change. Those early 70s, or not the early 70s, those 70s games and the early 80s games before John Jefferson are brutal. They have such difficulty moving the ball. Dickey throws bad interceptions. They don't score very much. They're horribly crushing to watch. And then they get John Jefferson, and then they're exciting. And then at the end, horribly crushing to watch because the team turns the ball over. So, yeah, very interesting. And the funny thing is Lynn Dickey changes from number 10 to number 12. And shortly after he becomes number 12, he becomes a much better player. So it's very strange how that worked out. And one comment I wrote down that I just thought was funny is that in 1981, the Packers had a cornerback by the name of Mark Lee, who was a pretty decent player. And the announcer, I wrote down verbatim what he said. The announcer said, Mark Lee was clocked having run the 40 in the combine of 4.4, which would seem to me to be close to impossible. Which nowadays, guys who are 4.4 are not even among the fastest guys in the draft. There's guys who are 4.4 who don't even get drafted. So it's funny that in 1981, 4.4 was considered impossible. I mean, we're 10 years removed from guys like Ahmad Carroll running 4.25s. So, yeah, bigger, stronger, faster. As entertaining as those old games were for me to watch at times, the guys today are just freaks of nature. And I mean that in the nicest way possible. Bart Starr, as the coach of the Packers, always looked completely miserable on the sidelines. And I don't know if that's just his demeanor during the games, and there are not many existing games of him playing. So maybe that's just how his serious face looks, but he looked like he was not having a good time out there. And I know he probably didn't want to get fired, and it caused some bad feelings, but I think he was probably much happier when he was no longer the coach of the Packers, because those were some tough years. And having mentioned John Jefferson, I wrote a note on here that said if I were 10 years older, and at least 10 years older to have seen this. Anyways, I said John Jefferson would have been my favorite player. He made amazing catches. He was gritty. He was a good blocker. He was a great teammate. I'm trying to think of somebody that would be like a John Jefferson in today's NFL. You'll have to give me a minute on that one. But, yeah, just if anybody who likes this old stuff, I know there's a few of you out there, if you have anybody in today's NFL that you would compare to John Jefferson, let me know, because I really, really want to think of a comparison now, because he is just amazing. Let's see what else I have here. I already talked about Lynn Dickey and stuff. The game was very simpler, much like me. I'm a simpler person, I guess. The game was much simpler back then, and I wrote down how the Packers used to run a reverse with James Lofton like once a game. Now it feels like teams spend weeks trying to set up a big play like that, and they would run a reverse every single game, and it usually would work. And it's remarkable to see how much simpler the game is. Frank Gifford made some comments in a game I was watching Packer Monday night game, where he was admiring teams that wouldn't play the same defense all the time. Now, just think about that now with teams who run so many different packages and so many different personnel formations and personnel makeups. And Frank Gifford's like, oh my gosh, they subbed a guy, or they played a 3-4, now they're playing a nickel. And that was something to be admired. So very interesting on that front. The three-man Monday Night Football team, having just talked about Frank Gifford, is unlike anything I've ever heard. If you're a fan of old NFL, if you got to this point in the podcast, I should stop saying that. If you got to this point in the podcast, clearly you're a fan of old NFL, more than the average person. But if that three-man team is always talked about as like the glory days of Monday Night Football, and I never really quite believed it. I'm like, yeah, okay, how good is Howard Cosell and Don Meredith? And they are as close as I've ever heard to fans just commenting on the game as it happened. And it's a very endearing, but also different. It's kind of edgy. It's hard to describe without hearing a game, but it is unlike, I'm sure, any announcer pairings you've ever heard. I mean, people talk about now, like Gruden and Chris Collinsworth, how they can be, you know, controversial, or John Madden. Even Madden didn't really come close to Cosell and Meredith for the kind of strange dynamic they had calling games. And it's really unique and interesting. I won't say they're the best team ever by any means, but they had a unique spot, and there's definitely a spot in today's NFL for a unique perspective like that. So I just thought I would throw that out there. I really don't have a whole lot more to say about this. If somebody has any questions or wants me to talk about anything from the 80s, I can't imagine there's many of you out there, but if there are, let me know. Two more points that I would like to make before I wrap it up. Three more, actually. The conventional wisdom that the early 80s Packers had great offenses ruined by poor defenses was only true in 1983. The rest of the years, they had pretty good defenses, and they just ruined it themselves with poor turnovers, bad play. The offense would be great one week, and they'd come back the next week and play a bad team and score like 3 points, turn the ball over six times. So 1983 is the year that created this idea that Lynn Dickey and James Lofton and John Jefferson were this unstoppable offense that was betrayed by their poor defense. Only in 1983 was that true. The rest of those years, in fact, a lot of times it was the opposite of that, where the offense was losing games, the defense was keeping them in, and the offense still couldn't take it. So that's something to remember if you're a nerd like me who cares about seasons this old. The other thing I will say is, Nike, please do not ever change the Packers uniforms. It was so cool to watch these old games, having the Packers look almost identical to the way they looked this past Sunday, playing against the old Buccaneers, the old Buffalo Bills, the old Seattle Seahawks, and just all of these old teams. Almost every single team they played had different uniforms than they have today, and the Packers in their classic uniforms look exactly the same. So don't change ours, or Dallas, or the Raiders, or any of those teams. I don't care what you do to Jacksonville, or to San Diego, or to any of those kind of teams. Change them all you want. I mean, I don't know if Nike's responsible and for Purdue on Saturday. That was a whole other story, and they had kind of a ribbon-shaped thing on the back of their helmet, so if I'm speaking of ignorance and their color change were for some sort of cause, I apologize. But the Purdue alternates they wore on Saturday were not even Purdue's colors. They were Oregon's colors on Purdue, a team that has the same color as the Saints. So Nike is messing with everything. I'll say I could live with that, but you got to leave the classics alone, because that's one of the coolest things to see a team from 50 years ago look exactly the same as a team from last Sunday. And lastly, I will bring this up before I wrap up. There's some other guys I wanted to mention, but this is getting rather long. The losing. I watched 40 games over the course of 4 or 5 weeks, and it was miserable watching the Packers lose all the time. And this went on for 25 years, 30 years between Super Bowl championships, and I have to take my hat off to anybody who was a devoted fan during that era, or anybody today who's listening to this show that's a devoted fan of a team who loses a lot, especially a team that you care about that much. The Brewers lose a lot. They haven't been great, but the Brewers are kind of your lovable loser team if you're me or a Wisconsin fan. You don't have a lot of expectations, so when they do something like make the playoffs, you're pleasantly surprised. but when they don't, it doesn't crush you. I can't imagine caring about the Packers as much as I do right now, and how people appeared to care about them so much in the 70s. They beat the Patriots on Monday Night Football in 1979, and they celebrate like it's the Super Bowl. And the guy who taped it, I don't know how he got it, but it has full commercials, full halftime, and it has Channel 11, WLUK, in Green Bay, their post-game newscast. And it's the coolest thing I've seen in my collection. And they cover it live like the Packers just won the Super Bowl. They beat the Patriots in 1979 in Week 5, a team that the year before lost in the divisional round. That would be, I'm trying to even think of another example, that would be the equivalent of the Packers, I don't know, beating Cincinnati or something and celebrating like it was the biggest achievement in franchise history. And that's how dedicated those fans were, 10, 12 years of losing. And they were in for that and then some more losing, 25 years of losing, and they never lost the interest. I have games from 1990, 1991, where it's 25 years, and that's why I love this mug that I have here from my late father, because it's the 1991 Collector's Edition. This is 25 years after they won anything important, and he still wanted to buy Packers memorabilia. And I know he's not alone. There's tons of fans out there. And it sucks to lose. And I hated it. And all I had to do was lose old games that didn't matter in a five-week period at my own leisure time. And to have that be your loser team all the time, and if for years, and I know I'm kind of belaboring this point, but holy cow, my hat's off to longtime fans of sports teams that just plain suck, because I've never been tested that way with my favorite sports team. I'm sure it'll come sometime in my life, but I'm not ready for it, and I don't know if I could do it. So I hope I can be as good a fan as you guys, because the fans like that are the people that keep the NFL afloat. Anybody can get on board and cheer for Seattle this year, or now start cheering for Dallas, or cheer for the Denver Broncos. And not to say that those teams don't have great fans, because they do. But you can be a bandwagoner. It's not hard to support these teams that lose forever, week in and week out, for decades, for a quarter century, and not lose the faith is awesome. And so hats off to you guys. I don't know if I could have done it, because I had had enough after 5 weeks, not 25 years. So that's my trip down the very distant memory lane. I hope you somewhat enjoyed that rambly podcast. I've been wanting to share some of that. I know some of you guys like the old stuff. So if you don't, you could have skipped out after Matt's segment. So I'm going to wrap it up here. If you want to contribute, I would love to hear your thoughts about some of the stuff I just talked about, or the stuff Matt and I talked about before. You can do that on our Facebook page, Green and Gold Forever Podcast. You can also do it at Twitter. I've been much more active on Twitter this year. At Green Gold Forever is the Twitter handle. That's, of course, the number 4. You can email us, greenandgoldpodcast@gmail.com. And also, don't forget, as I said before, KZ Radio on Friday afternoons is the Green and Gold Forever preview. And they got some great tunes. Like I've said before, if you like any of the songs that we use at the beginning of this episode, you'll love KZ Radio. Every time I go in there, they're playing a song that I haven't heard in years. And so give it a shot, listen to the Green Gold Forever preview, and then, you know, just stay on KZ all day, because you won't be disappointed if you're into that kind of music. So all right, so hopefully the Packers win, and hopefully the audio doesn't come off too wrong. We've had some audio problems lately, so I hope the audio is okay. And we'll hear from you guys next week. Take care, everyone.